say a special word of thanks again to Amkita and Melissa, who you just saw leaving. Melissa is a member of the Presbyterian Church across the street. I'm so glad to see college students back here at the church. Glad you to present today. Today we lit the pink candle, and as many of you know, if you're familiar with Advent churches, you know that the pink candle is lit on the day when the Magnificat is read. The Magnificat is that section in Luke, starting in verse 46, or known as 53, which is an ancient hymn of praise. It's a song of praise that Mary gives to God, and probably is recorded and remembered before the time that Luke actually describes it. Luke's probably taking it from the early tradition and inscribing it into Luke's text when this text is penned. And so the Magnificat is read almost every year in almost every Christian church. It's a very famous passage of Scripture and also a really interesting passage of Scripture. One of the reasons I think it's interesting is because if you look carefully at the wording of it, in verse 46, you'll see that there are numbers of different kinds of translations of the Magnificat, but in this version, which is the inclusive version, what it says is, "You have looked with favor upon your lowly servant, and from this day forward, all generations will call me blessed." You look with favor on your lowly servant. The term there, lowly servant, actually, if you go back to the King James, which is translated kind of very clunky, it's translated very clunkily, very woodenly out of the Greek. I think it says, you have shown mercy to the low estate of your handmaid, I think is what it says. The low estate there is an adjective, tapenosis in Greek, which is really the idea of powerlessness. You have paid attention to the powerlessness of your doulos, the word is in Greek. I'm a slave, almost, is how it's really translated. One of the things that the early church remembered about Mary was this song of praise. And it gets to the root of what Advent is about. Oh God, you have seen my state of powerlessness, and that I have been dragged down. The same word is translated in Acts chapter 8, referring to Jesus being on the cross as a humiliation. You see my humiliation, how I've been dragged down, and you have lifted me back up. And so if you read on further, it says, you have shown strength with your arm. You have scattered the proud in their conceit. You have deposed the mighty from their thrones and raised the lowly to high places. You have filled the hungry with good things, and you have sent the rich away empty. This is a passage about power. It's about people who realize that they are powerless, and about the conviction that salvation means God understands those who are powerless, and is on the side of those who are powerless. That God's will is to strip power away from those who are too powerful and to return or to invest power back in those who are powerless, whose power has been taken away. And because of this, she says, I rejoice. And there's joy in a mutuality of giving and receiving. We know that in our own relationships. And so when we think about what makes us happy, it's when we have the ability in a mutual way to give and receive goods from others. But when there's a difference in power, and one person's way up here and the other person's way down here, it's very difficult to have joy. This is the fourth Sunday. This is the candle of joy. And so it's important when we think about joy to think about power. Because it's important to realize that we can't honor and care for others who we subdue beneath us in a proper way. There has to be a mutuality of giving and receiving for us to be truly happy. In order for there to be peace, and the whole Advent season we've been focusing on welcoming peace, there has to be that joy that comes from a re-equilibration of right relationship, where the people who have been divested of power are reinvested with the power they deserve. And I think in this church we're pretty good about talking about that. That comes up over and over again. But one of the things that the Canadian church does better than the American church is that it sort of forces us to think in different ways. And this Advent season, we've been borrowing from the United Church of Canada a sort of a set of themes to go through Advent with. And the theme has been Shalom for all creation. And the first week, we talked about what would it mean for there to be peace for rocks and minerals and water? What would it mean for us to be in right relationship? What would it mean for us to be in right relationship to plants and air? Because in order for there to be real peace on earth, we have to be in right relationship with the other parts of the system. And this week, what the Canadian church has decided to focus on is the animals. What would it take for us to be in right relationship with other kinds of animals on this planet? Do we extend the principle beyond the principle of re-equilibrating power in order to find the mutuality of joy? Not only to other Homo sapiens, but we do it to the animal kingdom. We hardly ever talk about this in Christian churches. So we're going to spend one whole Sunday thinking about it today. For the next 10 months, I'm going to think just a little bit about that. And I'm happy, for example, to think that over the past 45 years that I've been alive, things have changed a lot. I remember that when I was young, and my parents, my father would take me out hunting. The idea was, you shoot anything that moves. It's fair game. Because the kind of idea was, just like weeds that you pull out of the garden, you pull them out and the next day they're back. So you can just keep pulling them out forever and they'll just automatically come back. There was a kind of very unintentional view about how we use animal creatures. I remember even when I was growing up. I didn't hear much about conservation or anything like that in school. And I notice now, as my own kids are going through the school system, they hear a lot more about species being lost because of human activity. They hear a lot more about conservation. They hear a lot more about how if we pollute our oceans and we continue to pollute our air, if we continue to pump toxins out into the atmosphere, animals are going to die. And we have some responsibility to prevent that. And so I think things are changing in a good way. I'm encouraged by it. I'm encouraged that today, since the ban was agreed to worldwide on PCBs back in 1979, there is less PCBs in this population, which means that animals that eat those fish are becoming healthier and healthier and having more babies. We've seen real progress in some of these things that we've paid attention to and we've changed policy on because we realize the effect that policy has had. In the last 10 years, some of the most ambitious ecosystem protection programs ever established and been invented to protect coral reefs because we're realizing they're overfishing the oceans in many places. But we need to save places where there can be healthy habitats for ocean creatures. There's more blue ocean now than there was 10 years ago. For the first time, I heard this report last week that right whales who have been extinct from their normal home on the New Zealand coastline have finally returned. After 100 years, they're coming back to some of these places. So news is good as far as our ability to understand that we have made some real errors in terms of the way we thought about animals. There's more awareness, that means that there's more protection. But we still have a long ways to go when we think about the struggle for shalom, for all creation. If we take seriously that God is a God who sees the powerlessness of people who have been stripped of power, then it also makes sense to us that we would understand God as a God who sees the powerlessness of all creation that has been stripped of its power and is concerned with that. This is a widening of the circle of peace that we talked about last week. I remember my grandmother, just a number of weeks ago, I was down there to see her, and my grandfather this year, I shared the story with somebody who has recently moved to a long-term care facility, early onset dementia, and just changed him over the summer. And now he's in the facility, but before he went into that facility, one of the things that I'm convinced that made his mind change so dramatically and so quickly is that they had lost a dog that had been their companion for 14 years. And when that Nishan died, Grandpa went into depression. He started sitting in his chair. He wouldn't get out of his chair. So Susan's back there nodding her head. Susan, the reason I asked Susan to come and Jeff light the candle this morning is because Susan has gone to a program, Animal Chaplaincy Training Work, where she's learned all about the connections that humans have with animals and how important those connections are. And if you want to talk to somebody in the church that knows a lot about that, talk to Susan Gomer. And it's interesting to me that after Grandpa was put into the long-term care facility, some stray cats wandered into the back of Grandma's house. And guess what I started hearing on the phone? Hey, I took those cats out. And there were three kittens. And all of a sudden, the conversation's about the kittens. Every time I talk about the kittens, I took the kittens out to see Grandma last week. And most of the time, I spent trying to get one of the kids to get under the bed and get the kittens out so we can show us the kittens. Because that care that she's able to provide for those animals is an important part of what makes her human and what gives her meaning. And there's something about that that's interesting, isn't it? There's something about us as humans that allows us to realize intuitively and naturally that we're connected to other species of life on this planet and that we can't simply use other animals as resources. And so this is why I say, we have a long way to go still when we think about what it might mean for us to create shalom for all creation. We do a pretty good job about caring for domesticated animals, but it's interesting to me, for example, that the names of a lot of them, and I talked about this last week, and when we talked about the Department of Natural Resources, do you realize that in a lot of colleges, what used to be called the Department of Animal Husbandry has been changed now to the Departments of Meat Science. Think about that for a minute. And what it means for animals. Meat science. We have a culture full of people who takes care of the animals that are closest to us, but we kind of ignore the animals that we don't see. We kind of forget that there are big facilities run by Tyson and Smithfield and ConAgra out there where 400, 500 pound animals like pigs are kept in 7 foot by 22-inch crates their entire lives. They never see the light of day. They break a leg and they lay there. That's not such a big deal because they're intended for food. They're not intended to be able to walk on their legs. And I think to myself, how much really do we pay attention to our connection with other life on this planet? Do we treat other creatures who are far less powerful than we are in a way that acknowledges their own intrinsic worth? I think that there's a lot to be talked about here. I'm going to read you one little section from a book that I was introduced to by Susan. The Humane Society puts out a pamphlet called The Religious Case for Compassion for Animals, and it's an excerpt from a book by Matthew Scully called, and you'll like this, Dominion. The power of man, the suffering of animals, and the call to mercy. Many times in our own Christian churches, we talk about our relationship to the earth as a relationship of dominion. And there's some problems with that. This is what Matthew Scully writes in one of these sections where he talks about factory farms. With sanctimony and deep dishonesty, factory farm corporations like Smithfield Foods, ConAgra, and Tyson still cling to countrified brand names for their labels. Clear Run Farms, Murphy Family Farms, Happy Valley, to convince us of about themselves, too, that they're engaged in something essential and wholesome and honorable. Yet when corporate farmers need barbed wire around their family farms and happy valleys, and laws to prohibit outsiders from taking photographs, as is the case in many states, and still other laws to exempt farm animals from the definition of animals, as covered in federal and state cruelty statutes, something must be missing. Farmers used to talk about raising animals. They now talk about growing animals. What does that mean for us as people? As I came today, this is going to be one little section because I think this is a kind of an interesting part of Matthew Scully's privilege, which is a book. The care of animals brings with it often complicated problems in economics, ecology, and science. But above all, it confronts us with questions of conscience. Many of us seem to have lost all sense of restraint towards animals, an understanding of natural boundaries, respect for them as beings with needs and wants,
and a place and purpose of their own. Too often, too casually, we assume that our interests must always come first. And if it's profitable or expedient, that's all we need to know. We assume that all these creatures with whom we share the earth are here for us. We assume, in effect, that we are everything and they are next to nothing. Animals are more than a test of our character, of mankind's capacity for empathy, and for decent, honorable conduct and faithful stewardship. We're called to treat them with kindness, not because they have rights or power or some claim to equality, but in a sense because they don't, because they all stand unequal and powerless before us. Animals are so easily overlooked, their interests so easily brushed aside. And whenever we humans enter their world, from our farms to the local animal shelter to the African savannah, we enter as lords of the earth, bearing strange powers of terror and mercy alike. Dominion, as we call this power in the Western tradition today, requires our concentrated moral consideration. I hope to convey a sense of fellowship that I know many readers will share, a sense that all of these creatures in our midst are here with us, and not just for us. Though reason must guide us in laying down standards and laws regarding animals and examining the arguments of those who reject such standards, it's usually best in any moral inquiry to start with the original motivation, which in the case of animals, we may without being embarrassed say, is love. Human beings love animals as only the high can love them. The knowing can love the innocent, and the strong can love the vulnerable. When we wince at the suffering of animals, that feeling speaks well of us, even when we ignore it. And those who dismiss love for our fellow creatures as mere sentimentality overlook a good and important part of our humanity. It is true that we are often reminded that kindness to animals is among the humbler duties of human charity, though for just that reason, among the more easily neglected. And it is true that there are always enough injustices, and there are plenty of human suffering. And there is plenty of human suffering in the world to make the wrongs done to animals seem small and secondary. The answer is that injustice is not a finite commodity, nor our kindness and love. And where we find wrongs done to animals, it is no excuse to say that there are more important wrongs being done to human beings, and so let us concentrate on those. The wrongs are wrong, and often the little ones, when they are often shrugged off as nothing, spread and do the greatest harm to ourselves. I believe this is happening in our treatment of animals today. When in this series of messages we focused on welcoming peace into the world, I encourage you to know what it means for us to welcome shalom for all creation, to think seriously about our relationship with all living beings and our place on the planet. Is it enough for us to imagine everything else that exists around us as a resource? Or are we called to be in better relationship with all that exists around us? Welcoming peace might mean creating a world in which all feeling creatures can exercise some power, in which they can be a part of that giving and seeking, which is certainly a prerequisite for joy. Welcoming peace requires adjusting our power. That's the question and the solution of the Magnificat. It means growing justice. Do that in the word adjusting. Adjusting. Growing justice for all creation. That's right. God, we thank you for this beautiful plan. We thank you for our place that you've given us and help us not to overstep our bounds and to be wise in our relationship with you.